Well, as I said earlier, Epiphany is, it's that time we commemorate the wise men meeting of Jesus, the boy Jesus. So he wasn't a baby anymore, really. It probably happened a couple years later when he was a small child. But to be totally honest with you, I'm going to skip Epiphany. It's not that I think Epiphany is unimportant, but I kind of touched on that subject last week. And I guess this is partly due to how I operate sometimes. Either I'm too early or I'm too late. Okay, that's just the way I operate. But rarely am I ever on time. So with this having said that, I'm going to fast forward 12 years in the life of Jesus. And now he's 12 years old. And we read that story that Blake read this morning. Now to parents of teenagers, this is a really criminal act that I'm doing. It could be viewed as criminal, or at least or maybe even a huge relief. On the one hand, it's criminal because we parents want to be recognized for all the blood and the sweat and the tears we shed to get our children to the teenage years. That's the truth of it. Okay? If you're a parent of a teenager, if you have been a parent, and all the stuff that it took you, that you're ready to pull out your hair and you're ready to pound your head against the wall and do all these things to get your kid to maturity. So in a sense, it's criminal for me to fast forward 12 years, but I have to because it really doesn't say anything about what Jesus did in those 12 years leading up to this point. So to fast forward 12 years is like cheating in football or baseball or checkers. There's no satisfaction in it, but really when you think about it, it's unethical. It's immoral. It hasn't been easy, this parenting stuff. I'm going to admit that full out. All the conversations we've had, the disciplinary measures we've had to adopt, the lessons we tried to instill into our children, the questions we posed to each other, the questions we posed to God. And for you people, and I got no disrespect to anybody here, but to those people who have never raised a child, don't tell me how to raise a child, okay? Your knowledge is theoretical. Maybe you read it in a book, that's okay. But don't tell me how to raise a child. You have not been shaped by the hard knocks of raising real live offspring, okay? That's all there is to it. It's just reality. And I have no problem saying that. I'm not trying to offend anybody. We didn't like the hard knocks of being parents, okay? But at the same time, we wouldn't trade them for anything in the world because of the satisfaction we have of actually surviving them. And they made us who we are. Better or worse. This is who we are now. So we always say, you know, the parents are trying to mold the children. The children do some molding themselves of us. And sometimes parents don't like to, we don't want to admit that, but that's the truth. So to skip those 12 years of Jesus' life, it is somewhat criminal, but it also, I could say, it is a relief. I don't mean that parenting never stops when the child reaches teenage years. I got to tell you that too. It just means that raising a teenage presents a whole new set of challenges. Okay? It's kind of like undergoing a change of scenery. And a change of scenery can be good, really, when you think about it. Perhaps you were living in the flatlands of Michigan for all your life, okay? I mean, isn't Michigan considered pretty flat? Okay? Okay. But then all of a sudden you're plopped down in the middle of the mountains or near the ocean. And this change is new, and it's exciting, but it surely is going to cause you to assess the new environment. And you have to make necessary changes, okay? And I'm talking about when your child gets to that age of teenagerism, and they want to question everything about a life, okay? And your parenting skills, okay? Maybe one way to describe parenting is thinking of it as a wonderful canoe trip. Anybody here ever been on a canoe trip? I mean, there's always one of my bucket list items. You know, go to the boundary waters of Minnesota and go, you know, and canoe to some into the wilderness. But here's the thing about this: you only get one paddle on this canoe trip. And this paddle is needed for a variety of reasons. You might have two canoers in the canoe, but you only get one paddle. And this paddle is needed for a variety of uses. It needs to be for navigating. It needs to be for steering clear of the hazards, like the boulders and the whirlpools, sounding the depths, discovering where to pull off and maybe camp for the night. Disciplining. The paddle's good for disciplining. And serving. You ever get a sandwich? You ever fed you a sandwich on a paddle? God have mercy if you ever lose the paddle, okay? Don't lose the paddle. I say all this to bring us to the point in the Bible where the parents take Jesus on their annual canoe trip. It's really what they're doing. To the Feast of the Passover. It appears that they have been making this family trip faithfully for at least 12 years, probably even more, because Luke chapter 2, verse 41 says, every year his parents went to Jerusalem for the Feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to the feast according to the custom. It's not unrealistic to think that Mary and Joseph, their families, also took this trip. And they had their own travel party. And so this family trip was likely to have gone on for decades. Not just 12 years, but all these years before them when they were children. It's a true family tradition. A true family vacation in a sense. But this trip is going to be so much different in one significant way, and not so much for Jesus, but for the parents. Parents. Especially you folks that now have adult children. Okay? Do you recall, I want you to think back in your memory banks. Do you recall the time that perhaps you were sitting at the kitchen table? You were doing whatever, taking your old person pills or something like that. That's what I do. And your teenager quietly breezes by while you're sitting there at the table. And for an instant, you mistook them for somebody else. And at a second glance, you realized who they were. And when you did, you were taken aback. And the first thing that entered your mind was, wow, they've grown. They've matured. How they have changed into a young adult right before your very eyes. You were shocked and you thought to yourself, I didn't see that coming. But yet you did see it coming, but you didn't see it coming at that rate of speed. You knew that somewhere down the line, your child was going to grow up. But all of a sudden it happened right before your very eyes. I think this is what happened to Mary and Joseph on this particular trip when Jesus was 12. There was a singular and a seismic shift in the landscape as it pertained to the relationship with their son right there. He was no longer the little boy who unquestionably complied to all the parent wishes. He was starting to understand, well, he knew already, but he had a higher calling that was now manifesting itself into his choices and actions, and it threw his parents into a tizzy. And it took them a while to recognize and accept this shift, even though 12 years earlier, what happened? When the star had rested over the manger, and the shepherds had come to witness the holy birth of which the angels proclaimed, and the wise men showed up a couple years later bearing gifts. That would be the Epiphany. And the Bible says that Mary and Joseph did not understand what it meant when Jesus said to them, "Didn't you know I had to be in the Father's house?" He said that remarkable statement to his parents at 12 years old. And when you think about it, this is the age-old tension between parent and child relationship, isn't it? Parent says, "Hurry up and grow up, but not too fast." And the child says, "I want to hurry up and grow up, but I really don't want the responsibilities of an adult. I'm still a child." And this is what perhaps is going on. I don't know for sure. But so the seismic shift happens. And the question is, does this mean that this seismic shift, that everything changed in the Messiah's household when they returned to Nazareth? Think about it. It says they went after this whole Feast of the Passover, they went back home to Nazareth. Did Jesus start making more of the household decisions for his family when he got home? Did he put on the refrigerator and say, okay, family, this is our budget for this week? Did Jesus say that? Is that how it works in your household? The Bible doesn't seem to point that out either. Instead, it says, he went to Nazareth, when he returned to Nazareth, with them, and he was obedient to them. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a beautiful thing right there. Jesus, really, he could have stayed at Jerusalem and went to Bible camp. He could have began networking. He could have started developing those all-important relationships with the scholars, who would one day have to make a choice about following him. And in a sense, it'd be kind of like, you remember Samuel, the boy Samuel, and his mother dedicated him to the temple, and he basically lived there at the temple, and she would come visit on occasion, I suppose, but that became his new home. Couldn't that have happened with Jesus? No, it says Jesus returned to Nazareth. He went home. Because I think he went home with his mom and dad knowing that he was still under their authority. He had much to learn from them and to receive from them. And likewise, he had much love to give them. And I think that's important. He had much love to give them in his human 12-year-old boy love. And every parent cherishes that. Sometimes I'm sitting, maybe watching a football game, and I see my 12-year-old son, or he's only 11, I guess, right? 11. And I see him, I just want to go over there and squeeze the stuffing out of him. Cause it's like, hey, he's not going to be that young. He's going to get older, and then he's not going to like it when I wrestle with him like that anymore. Now, you might think that at this point, my whole message is about parenting and recognizing your child's gifting and how to loosen the reins on your child so he can reach the full potential that God has given him. And that's part of it. But my message is so much more than this. It is that we have to get this out of the message, and that is a seismic shift has to occur in our relationship with God, just like it happened to Mary and Joseph. When they were taken aback by Jesus' statement, didn't you know I had to be in my Father's house? We have to have that seismic shift in our own personal life, or we cannot move forward with God in our relationship with Him. I kind of put this in the context of earth science. You know, I've tried to understand the earth science and how the earth works, and I'm not very good at it really, But in the context of earth science, a massive amount of energy is released anytime the earth is covered with these things called tectonic plates, and they're kind of floating on the mantle and they move about and they shift about. I mean, it's imperceptible to us really, but sometimes they get caught up on each other, or sometimes one goes under the other one, or some, you know, they do these crazy things, or they get hung up on each other, and then all of a sudden they let go and they release a lot of energy. A huge amount of energy is released, and these waves are given off. P waves, those are primary waves, S waves, secondary waves, and they can cause a lot of damage. On the other hand, some of these energy that's released is almost imperceptible. Even the scientists, you know, most sensitive instruments, they don't pick those up, but they might a little bit. We don't feel them. But it happens thousands of times a day on the earth. I don't know if you realize that, but earthquakes. One time I looked up, I said, how many earthquakes happen in a given day in the world? And it said, I think it was over 1,000. We don't, maybe a couple of them, register. But the question I want to ask you today is, are we sensitive to these releases of energy? Are we sensitive to these moments in our lives like Mary and Joseph had? Do we recognize them as God's energy directed toward us to move us toward Him? Do we understand them? I mean, and maybe we do, maybe we don't. I don't know. But here's what I'm asking you. Are we willing to do what Mary did? And this is the thing that I want to kind of camp on this morning. Mary treasured up all these things in her heart. When that seismic shift happened, when that energy was released, when that shock wave hit, Mary and Joseph. And I don't know how Joseph handled it. It doesn't really say. It says one place he said they were astounded by what they were saying about his son. But it says Mary treasured all these things in her heart. Luke writes that Mary had a similar reaction when the shepherds came to visit them on the night of Jesus' birth. Luke 2:19 says that the child's mother and father marveled at what was said about him. Oh, that had to do with Simeon's prophecy in the temple. So when Jesus was 8, they took him to the temple to have him circumcised. And they marveled at what they said. And it says, and Simeon said, "My eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of people, a light up for revelation to the Gentiles and for the glory of the people of Israel." So these things, these truths, these events, more than once it says, Mary treasured them in her heart. And to be honest with you, I have been perplexed by that saying for a long time. What does it mean to treasure something in your heart? I've had a vague notion. I think we all have a vague notion of what that might mean. Sometimes it's like, think on the subject often. Never forget it. Keep it safe or cherish or guard it safely. And I thought about that, and that's kind of my vague idea of what it means, but that to me is unsatisfactory. I need something more. I need another handle to hold on to. And then I came across one reference that said this. Not to say it is this, but it said it could mean to follow an action through to a definite result. I thought that was very interesting. That's different. To treasure something in your heart is to make a commitment to seeing something through to the end. That's different. I never thought of it that way. Before, I had thought it had something to do with tucking something away, putting it on the layaway plan, keeping it hidden and safe for a rainy day sort of thing. That's what treasuring meant. But this reference said it has more to do with holding this truth out in front, not protecting it from harm, letting it shine brightly, guiding us, directing us, helping us fulfill our commitments and mission. And when you think about that from Mary's perspective, doesn't that make sense? Doesn't every bone in Mary's body want to protect and guard and keep safe her son from the darkness and the evil of the world? Every mother, it's instinctual. This is the mama bear in a woman. Every mother wants to do this for her children. It's built into them. And Mary is no different. And yet, she has a very extraordinary son. And he has a mission to accomplish. Unlike any other mission ever given to a human. It is otherworldly. It is supernatural. To be the light to the Gentiles? To be the glory of Israel? To be the Savior of humanity? So Mary, going back to the mother of Jesus, by treasuring these things in her heart, really it means she doubles down on her commitment to follow an action through to its final and definite result. That's what I see here. And that means for her specifically is to raise her boy to a young man status so that he can fulfill his mission. And guess what? She's only 12 years into it. She still has nearly 20 more years ahead of her to fulfill the commitment. Because what? Jesus is probably 30 when he starts his public ministry. Wow, she has a long row to hoe in front of her. Another 20 years. I thank God for Mary's commitment. Now how about us? What will we hold in front of us to keep us going toward Jesus and toward the fulfillment of his mission which he has given us? You may be sick. You may be exhausted. You may be, what's the word, jaded and cynical and think, boy, I'm doing all this stuff. What's the payoff? What is the fruit? I was so happy when Julie gave me that website, or not the website, but the about hearing that preacher preach. Because I remember standing up in front of him, and he was out, and I can't even remember the play. I was here. He and Stephanie were right over there in that area of the church, faithfully. That was many, many years ago now, wasn't it? Makes me feel old, actually. What will we treasure in our hearts that will keep us moving forward? Into a life of holiness, into a life of godliness, into a life of service. Maybe it will be different for each of us, at least in how we express it personally. But however we express it, it has to encompass really the fundamental truth about God and His Son and His relationship to us. That can never change. That the Father has sent the Son into the world to bring us back to Himself. Not because we are worthy, not because He was bored and nothing else to do, but because, the Bible says, God is love. And he is willing to move heaven and earth to make it happen. And sometimes it's these little seismic shifts in our lives. Having your teenager walk by you and you realize, wow, they're not a child anymore. And so many other ways. Maybe it's giving you that illness for a month where you finally have to come to terms with, you know, What am I doing here? Is asking that question. But God is love, and He has moved heaven and earth to help us understand it. I hope you see this truth this morning. I hope you embrace it. I hope you, in the words of what Luke said about Mary, treasure it in your heart. Because guess what? It will be the guiding light. It will, in the days to come, it will be your guiding light. In the days and the months and the years to come.